Anyway, they looked at the car and gave it a fair shake. It was in the same room when we approved the one that we were doing, and it received a very slight amount of damage when it was coming over, and we endeavored to repair that, and we gave it the best shot we could. We put real wheels under it instead of the styrofoam wheels, and we didn't want to destroy the concept of the car for sure. For a couple of reasons. He would have been upset, and we weren't really anxious to help him that much, and it would have been major surgery on that car anyway to make it look better than it looked. But in any event, we had the big shootout at the OK Corral, and we had our car there, which by this time, of course, was all spit and polish finished and a hand rub paint job on it, and it was an opened up car, which DeJaro's was not. But he had the choice of doing that. He could have had a much better proposal than he sent in, because I don't recall what the contract was, but there wasn't a real cap on it. He could have spent a lot more money and done a better job on it than he elected to do. But it was kind of I know Jerry Myers was very much disappointed in the car. He even confided in me that it wasn't what he expected. I think those were his words. And it certainly wasn't, and I could understand his saying that. But anyway, at least it proved again that he had a damn good team working for him. And I think he really knew that, with the exception of a couple of individuals that he just had a personal dislike for. So we went on, and we contracted with, just to fill out the AMX 3 story, we contracted with Bizzarini, who was a builder of high-performance vehicles. And Bizzarini. Oh, boy, don't ask me to spell it. Bizzarini, I guess, is close enough. That's phonetically spelled, I guess. Anyway, he did all the chassis work, utilizing as many of much of the componentry as he could.
From was he?
He was a custom Italian bodybuilder and a very well-known sports car builder in Livorno, Italy. And nice guy, very nice guy, and very talented. And he redesigned, of course, he had to redesign the whole rear suspension, but the front suspension was basic on the 3, was basically like the standard car, because the rules were to once the shape of the car was approved, and of course we knew everything was going to go under it, but none of that had been engineered, and the workload was so heavy at AMC that they had a couple of project engineers assigned to the program, but they contracted with Bizzarini to do a great portion of the engineering of the vehicle, which meant doing rear suspension and all that sort of things, because it was a mid-engine car. And then we contracted with Otto Malara to build the transaxles, and they did an excellent job on that.
They're
in Italy, I think, in Milano. I'm not sure, but it's an Italian military builder. They build all the Italian military vehicles, and they also do a lot of civilian work too, of course. And they were. At that point in time, there weren't very many mid-engine cars around. There were a lot of them programmed, but there weren't that many around. There was a Mangusta and two or three others, which all used a ZF transmission, a Zeta. And in fact, the first AMX 3 had a ZF transmission in the back, and it was only for test purposes.
Zeta.
And that actual car is still in existence. All 6 of the cars, we built 6. We had 30 programmed, but we only got to 6, and that program went down the chute because of many, many, many reasons, not the least of which is the ability to allow, or the inability to find a manufacturer in Europe that could build this for the very tight prices, the cost that Jerry Myers was pushing for. We went to Karmann in Germany, who made the Porsche bodies and many others. Karmann Ghia, you've heard of that, of course.
Right.
And anyway, but Karmann went through the program this was before, of course, the car was introduced, and we were trying to get things together to make it happen. We had a guy by the name of Hal Siegel that was assigned to this project in Europe to make the thing come together, and he and I and Jerry went to many of the bodybuilders over there to see if we could build this thing, because the price, Jerry was very firm on having to sell for no more than $10,000, which was logical, because that's what the Pantera was supposed to sell for originally when it was introduced. And this was a direct competitor to that, so it would carry the AMC name. Like obviously, an AMX 3 became the name of the car. Jerry named that, as a matter of fact. I came up with a name AMX originally for the old two-passenger, but then he added the slash 3 on it to dub the mid-engine car with that name.
Arabic numerals.
Yes, Arabic numerals. Mm-hmm. And so the car is being developed by Vizzarini. We had the first one with the ZF transmission and 390 in the back. Tested at BMW, and I was over for part of that program just on a trip over there to see the car as much as anything. And it was kind of a funny little sideline to this thing. When we sent the fiberglass shell over there from which the prototypes were built, there was some kind of a glitch somewhere with one of the project engineers. They didn't have many assigned to it. Joe Bishop was one and a couple of others, but there was some kind of a glitch, and when Kojula, who was a Torino builder of, at that time, he's very well known today, as is Giugiaro and others, but at
how
that
you
time,
spell that?
Kojula, God, I don't know, C-O-G, A-L-A, Kojula, I'm wrong on that, but anyway, he's a fairly well known custom body. In fact, he always shows up with two or three special cars at the Torino show once a year. But anyway, he was given the job. This is like 15, 16 years ago. So he was given the job of through Vizzarini. I found out that working with the Italians that you can't really find out who's doing the job, because you give it to one guy and he farms it out and the other guy farms it out, and you wind up with a hodgepodge of different guys working on this thing. That doesn't mean it's all that bad. But, Kojula had somebody else in some little shop beat out the body panels, and then Vizzarini was sending suspension units out to some other company, and they were making those, and they were sending other pieces of that to still another company. And oh my God, it was like trying to put a pair of slacks on an octopus or something. But it was really an enormously complex problem, and this was just to get the prototypes finished. So in the meantime, we're trying to get some viable bodybuilder from Carmen to several other companies that we looked at in Italy and Milano and Turing. We looked at Turing and several others, and the price was not right, because Jerry was so steadfastly holding to the bottom line price that would be on the sticker, if you had stickers in those days, on the side window. That would be $10,000 with a few options available, but basically that would be the price of the car, because he wanted to be competitive with the Pantera, which was purported to be going to be sold for that kind of a figure. But anyway, it was a kind of a breech birth kind of a thing, and it was never really born. The car was never. I've got two of the cars, and there was only six ever built. In fact, up until about 3 years ago, my last trip to Italy, I thought there were only five. Although I'd heard rumors that there was a sixth one. Well, the reason that happened is that, again, with Vizzarini farming out different things to different people, he had a fellow by the name of Diamanti, who was one of his suppliers, and Diamanti was elected. I don't know what the hell he was supposed to do, because we thought Vizzarini was doing it all, but we understood that he was getting other people to do things for sure, but we were paying him for the project, and then he was subcontracting all his stuff out. Well, Diamanti was one of those subcontractors, and when the program was canceled, we were going to build 30 prototypes. Well, they had built, they had the one. The sixth one, the car that now lives in Italy, Diamanti still has it. Mm. That car was really a throw-in to me, because I had no idea. I'd been telling, I'd give talks or whatever, talk to reporters. I'd say, yeah, there were five built. Well, it turns out there was a sixth one. And I'm not so damn sure there isn't going to be another one show up someday, because there were two bodies. In fact, I saw one of them when I was over there on one of the trips, and I saw the one that has turned out to be the sixth car. And that car had everything was stuffed in it. It had everything but the mechanicals. It had the body was finally finished. It had all the incorporated changes on the car from the first five, such as windshield wipers that retracted and a combing at the base of the windshield. And it had 4 inches more overhang in the back, which didn't help it. I was always upset about that, because that part of the charm of that car is that bobtail look. It's very, very short in the rear overhang. And you can do that, of course, with the mid-engine and the transaxles after that, and you don't have anything that you have to package beyond the wheels, really. So it's a very much of a bobtail car. Well, the reason that Siegel elected, and he was the guy that was following it over there, he made that call. I didn't. He told me after it was over, but he said, yeah, we added a little length to the back of the car, Teague. And I said, yeah, how much? And he said, 4 inches, and I almost dropped dead on the end of the phone. I said, why'd you do that, Hal? And he said, well, we couldn't package a standard muffler, and he gave me all this other BS. And I said, you know, that's going to screw up the looks of that car. And in fact, it did. The sixth car is really, it looks, it just doesn't have the look of the first five. But anyway, when I heard through a guy by the name of Massimo Colombo over there, when I was over for the Turin show, that he said, you designed the AMX3. And I said, yeah. And he said, you know, there's another one. And I said, you're kidding me. He said, nope. He said, I'll take you over there. And we jumped in his little Fiat 124, and we went out into the boonies about 10 or 20 miles outside of beautiful downtown Torino, and went into this yard with this big building in the middle of it and some voracious man-eating dogs. I didn't dare get out of the car for a few minutes. I went into this place, and this guy is a restoration guy. He restores Bugattis and even had GT40 in there. Where he got that, I don't know, but he had a lot of Ferraris and Mangustas, and he had a couple of Bizzarinis, because he's a friend of Bizzarini, and he was restoring those, and a Lamborghini. He had all kinds of exotic cars in there, and by God, over in the corner, he had this AMX3 covered up, and I took pictures of it at that time. And he got, what he did, when the program was canceled, he told me with tears in his eyes in Italian, and I didn't know what he was talking about, except that Massimo did, and he told me with tears in his eyes that he just couldn't bear it to destroy such a beautiful car. You know, he was trying to patronize me too, and he knew I designed the thing. And but he was very, very complimentary about the car, and he said he just couldn't bear to cut that car up and scrap it. And he had talked. He threw the ball back at Bizzarini. He said Bizzarini wasn't there at this time, and he said Bizzarini agreed that car should not be destroyed. It should be saved for history. And he went on and on and oh God. But anyway, I was really glad that he had saved it, frankly. Yeah. And I said, okay, Mr. Diamante, through the interpreter, Massimo, I said, you know, how many more are going to come out of the woodwork? And he said, oh, no, they're all gone. He said, I have pieces. He had windshields, and he had shock towers, and he had a lot of other parts that he couldn't even scrap those. But I really wonder someday if there's a, you know, there's going to be another one of those things going to surface.
Another cobble together.
Yeah, another cobble together. But this one that he did, I did see that before it was, but I assumed it was junked or scrapped.
Mm-hmm.
And by God, he somehow scrounged a 3-neck because he didn't have an engine over there, and he got the right engine for it. I don't know how he got that, but boy, he scrounged around. And that car is probably closer, with the unfortunate fact that it's 4 inches longer than the tail, more overhang. It's probably closer than any of the other cars as far as what would have happened in production had the car ever seen the light of day as far as a production car is concerned.
You've got two of the AMX3s. Where are the others?
I've got two of them. I just recently, as a matter of fact, last Saturday, I let go of the worst one of the two that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all that bad, but it was not as good as the red one. I call them the red car and the yellow car. The yellow car was number 5. I thought that was the last car. It turns out Diamante's got number 6.
Mm-hmm.
I've also got number 3.
Mm.
And the number 3 car, I have a near and dear spot in my soft spot in my heart or my head on that car, because that was the one that we introduced in at the Conrad Hilton Hotel in Rome at the time we had the press showing in Europe, and I was over there with Jerry, and Jerry did all of the talking about the car, but I was there at that time, and that is the car that was outside of the hotel, and I have that car today, and when I get to California, I'm going to totally restore it.
Good.
It's not bad now, it was really a tough car, because those cars, after the program was canceled, they laid outside for almost 8 years at American Motors, and there were some rust spots on a number of them, and of course, the thing that stopped them from running was the famous manhole cover that was in the middle of Plymouth Road, next to the porno movie. That neighborhood down there is not exactly the thing you'd want to take your kids by, even in a locked car. But anyway, there was a famous manhole cover when they paved the streets down there at one time. This manhole cover stuck up about 3.5-4 inches above the surface of the street. And that's okay for most cars. But that manhole cover was the problem for 3 cars that we had there. 2 of them were the AMX3s. And the test drivers down there forgot really how low these cars were, because they got about a 3.5-4 inch clearance at the most from the ground, and their long wheelbase are 103-inch wheelbase, so you know, you can run over something that isn't very tall and you're going to have problems. And I put slightly larger tires on them, which screwed up the gear ratio on the back, but not bad. I'm not a hot rodder anymore anyway, and they run just fine, and they go just fine, and it's got a better top end, but getting there, it's a little slower. But anyway, I don't have that problem with clearance, but when those test drivers down in the garage were running these cars around, the first one to have the rear end torn out of it, and I'll tell you, it was really a disaster. It not only got the transaxle and powdered two of those, one in each car, but it also got the crankcase and the bell housing and everything else, and those things were an absolute living mess underneath. They looked great sitting in the yard, but boy, I'm telling you, there was oil all over the underneath, you know, where the everything had gone. And they towed them in on the back of a hook, and they set them in the corner, and they sat there for, you know, 5-6 years after the program was over. And I finally, one day in desperation, I'd go by there and see these things. They didn't even cover them up, and it really used to irritate me. And I didn't have any room in styling to put them undercover because we didn't have room enough for the new cars we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept pleading with, I guess Ralph Isbrandt first, and then Adamson, and finally Walsh and several others said, you know, just get them inside. Nah, that program's dead. We should really scrap the car as well. They never scrapped the cars, fortunately. And I finally wrote an impassioned letter to Roy Chapin and told him that because of my involvement with the car, I'd like to have both of them, and I would restore them someday, and that they would not be lost to history. And I've, in fact, done that. What did I do about the transmissions? Well, these transmissions were basket case. And that were really, because when I bought those cars, I hadn't the foggiest idea. I knew there were like 25 transmissions or 23 or whatever the figure was somewhere in the world, unless they had been scrapped and they were lost. We couldn't find these boxes of transmissions that were overseas in Italy.
Had been made by the ZF.
Had made by, no, these were not ZFs. These were the only AMX3 had a ZF in it was the very first one.
Oh, okay.
That car, to answer your question, to bounce sideways again for a minute, I'm babbling here, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
But I have two of the cars. There's
you
two of them as we
five.
Speak. I have 3 and 5.
Yeah.
Number one, which was the one that was lower than it should have been, when Kojula got the prints over there, he had the prints plus the shell, somehow somebody screwed up, and I don't know who the hell it was. It wasn't styling, but they got the car, like, would you believe, 3 inches lower, rather they couldn't convert inches to millimeters or what the hell ever the problem was. I don't know what it was. But they had this goddamn car built, and they got this frantic call from Siegel, who was supposedly following it. He should have caught it, but he didn't. But anyway, he called me and he said, God, you got to get over here, Jake. We got a tremendous problem. I said, what's the problem? He said, the first car that we're building is 3 inches lower than its design height. And I said, God, that's a disaster, all right. What can you do about it? And there weren't a lot of alternatives at this point because the whole body in the white was made. And they found it because when they stuck the power steering unit under the hood, it stuck up about 1.5 inches. Not 3 inches, but 1.5 inches.
Mm.
So anyway, here we are with a car that's in Italy at Kojula's shop. The body is virtually, almost literally finished. The way they found it, they put the hood on the car, and of course it wouldn't package. And, you know, what do you do? The car is already so damn low design height-wise that you can't do anything other than raise the car or put smaller wheels on it or whatever. There were some alternatives, none of which were very pleasant. But anyway, the bottom line is that this was the first car, and it we worked ourselves out of it. We relocated the power steering unit, which was the worst problem. But 3 inches is a hell of a lot to try to take care of. And I really don't know to this day where the hell they screwed up. We looked at the drawings over there, and we did everything, and it looked like it was an inch line problem when they converted from inches to millimeters or whatever. And but somebody should have caught it, but they didn't catch it till the car was ready to have the mechanical stuffed in. In fact, they were stuffing the mechanicals in the power unit brake, the boosted breaker system, and that's when they found it. And then, of course, they had a problem with the stuff in the engine in the middle of the car, and that was solved, too. And it really, we got out of it with not too much damage for the first car. And, of course, the cars thereafter were fine, but including the ones that I have are just fine. But cars are now 3 inches higher, and the wheel openings are lower, and the basic body opening and all that stuff. That was another problem with the opening of the wheel relative to the rocker panel and all that stuff. But anyway, we got it all worked out, and they got that car finished, and it was used as a test mule. Had a ZF transmission, and it was painted an insipid green. I don't know who called that one. It didn't matter anyway. But anyway, it was a car that was sent over to BMW, and they did a lot of chassis work on the thing, and the fact that the body shell on the chassis was 3 inches lower than it should have been. The chassis was okay, so it didn't really screw there. program up, and they did a lot of test work on the vehicle, cooling tests and things of that type. And it was really a cobbled car. I mean, it was really a cobbled car. Not only, well, at best, had it been the right design height, it would have been a rough car. But it wasn't, you know, aesthetically, you know, the surfaces were pretty good. I've got pictures of it, but it, you know, it had tape holding the windshield in, no moldings, they weren't made at that time, and had the wrong instruments in it, the wrong panel and everything. It was just a mule, you know, it was a test mule. Anyway, that car survives today, and it's over in Kalamazoo in the Gilmore Museum at
Hickory Corners.
Hickory Corners, exactly. I was trying to think of that. Thank you, Dave. So anyway, it's over at Hickory Corners, and it's sitting there in the corner. I got that car too. Jerry said, you know, it was such a mess that after they got through with the thing, he said, if you want that car, Teague, you can have it. Well, at this time, it looked like we were going to go through with the program because querying hadn't been canceled then. I said, okay, if they're through with the car, I would like to have it. So he said, you got to pick up all the tab. I'm shipping it over and taking care of all the Mickey Mouse governmental regulations. And although they weren't so bad then. It was in 68, I guess, 69. And I just wanted a car because I'd worked on it, even though it was out of package and a few other things. It actually looked pretty good, 3 inches lower, I got to admit. It was the lowest damn car I've ever seen. Well, it was like 40 inches high, you know, that's really down there. The car, the normal ones are 43. But anyway, when the car got here, it would be a little bit like taking a new Ferrari and dropping it off on the dock down at in Detroit here and letting it set for about 3 months. You can imagine what happened to it. Well, they stole the wheels off, they stole the instruments out of it, which weren't original anyway. I mean, they weren't the programmed instruments. They stole the seats out of it. The only thing that was on that car, somebody put some wheels on it just as a dolly. They were Chevrolet wheels or something. They drilled some holes in that or taken the studs out. They were the wrong bolts. Anyway, it was a mess. And when I saw that car, I went down, picked it up, paid the freight, paid the duty, paid the everything on the thing, got it home, and I had $1,186 in it, which you'd think is pretty good. But I'll tell you, the minute I started opening the crate, and it was in a crate, but it was put in the crate just before it was shipped. It wasn't put in the crate while it was sitting on the dock over in Genoa or where the hell ever it came from. And I'll tell you, that was one of the roughest cars. I don't give up easy, but that car had me thrown. I said, look, I'm not going to live long enough to ever get this thing back together. Even though by this time the program, by the time it got here, the program was dead. It was 6 months, I guess, by the time Jerry gave me the car and I got it over here. Gave it to me I had $1,200 in it, which isn't much. But the car wasn't much. My God, it was scrap metal. And I don't think that car will ever be restored. Now, the guy that I sold it to, which is a guy named Scotty Dawkins, who worked in the garage down here, he was in love with that car from the beginning. He said, look, he said, I'll buy it. Whatever you got in it, Teague, I'll pay you for it. So I said, you give me a check for $1,176. I just ran across the other day going through some stuff. And I said, that takes care of all my costs, and you come get the car. I've got it in my driveway. And he, in fact, did that. And we wobbled it off the trailer with these Chevrolet wheels on it, and it was, I'll tell you, there was no engine, no transmission. They'd even taken the steering wheel off of it. This thing was like a plucked chicken. It was nothing left of it. They'd stolen, of course, all the wheels off it, the Kojula wheels, and not the Kojula, the, doesn't matter, anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. They were Italian wheels, and it did have the right wheels on it when it was over. In fact, I was just looking at some pictures of it at BMW. Sitting in the yard over there, and it had all, you know, those were correct on it. The transmission was incorrect, but it didn't matter because it was gone anyway. It was a ZF, and they'd stolen everything. The car was gutted. I never saw such I'd never seen a car quite like that because there was nothing. There was no side glass in it. They'd broken the side glass out of it. The windshield was there, but it was all taped in with like furnace tape, Italian furnace tape, holding it in, and the backlight was there. And the side glass was there on the quarter windows. But other than that, the car was just a shell. Hell, you could push it with one hand. It was so light, there was nothing in it. Steering wheel was gone, as I say. All the instruments gone. Seats were gone. It was an absolute mess.
Dockside thieves had done this.
Dockside thieves had really plundered that car. So Scotty Dawkins got it. I said, hey, take it with my compliments, you know, and you can have it, baby. And nobody else even wanted it. There were a couple other guys that said, hey, you know, I'll bail you out. I said, the hell with it. I'd give it to somebody before I'd, you know. And I said to Scotty, I said, look, you got to promise me one thing, that, you know, that you really try to do something with the car, because you know, I'm just not going to live long enough. Nobody is. You're not going to, Scotty, but to get this car restored. And he said, yeah, what'll I do about a transmission? I said, look, don't bring any of those problems to me. That's your baby. You get a ZF or an Auto Malar or something and put in the thing. And I said, somewhere in this world, there's you know, there's two dozen transmissions sitting on a dock, and that's, in fact, what was the case. And I said, if I ever get those transmissions or hear about them, you know, I'll sell you one for the car or whatever it costs me for them. And I, in fact, did that. As it turned out, there was a statement that I made kind of lightly, but it turned out to be what happened. And so he got the car, and he immediately sees a hot rod guy, and he used to take Trans Am Javelins and AMXs and stuff, and just, I never liked what he did, but what he did was done pretty well. He went all the drag races with the AMX. He was carrying the red, white, and blue banner, and he wanted this car, and he was going to do that to that because he felt that he wasn't really destroying history because the car was so destroyed anyway. So he got the car, took it over to Grand Rapids where he lived, ultimately lived, and put it in storage for a while, and then he flared the rear fenders and he did a lot of god-awful things to it. But the car still does exist. It's over at Hickory Corners, and it's in the museum over there, and it's painted, oddly enough, yellow, which is the color of one of the cars I have. And but it's this car that's 3 inches lower, and so he flared the rear wheels because he wanted to put dragster tires on the back, and he did the damage. He completed the job when he got the thing. So the car is, it's a wreck. But it is car number one. And someday, you know, 50 years from now, somebody will probably have the ambition to bring it back. I don't know. So that's the number one car. Okay, the number two car was sold to a guy by the name of Sylvie down in Indianapolis.
S-I-L-V-E-Y.
S-I-L-V-E-Y, I think. Jim Sylvie, and he's in Indianapolis. And the other one sold by a guy whose name I don't know. But two of them, Siegel sold to, when the program was canceled, actually just before the program was canceled, we knew it was going. But he sold two cars and got them out of Italy and sent them down to Indianapolis, and the company got paid, you know, $8,000 a piece or something for them. We had over $1 million in the program, mm-hmm. Well over $1 million, plus all of the time that everybody spent on the thing and the, you know, the trips over and back, several of those. Mm-hmm. But the number two car Sylvie got, and the number four car wound up down there. The three car was still... was here. We had that here. That was one of the first ones that got here, and that's the one that I have now. That's a red car. And the number five car, so two and four are in Indianapolis as we speak. Number one, as we speak, is in Hickory Corners, and number three I have out here, and I had number five up until a week ago. And the number six car is a Diamante car, and that's down in it's over in Italy.
When you say Indianapolis, you mean the Indianapolis Museum?
No, they're a guy by the name of, is it Kaufman? Just bought that car from Sylvie a short while ago. And the other guy that owns one down there, he's kind of a weirdo, I guess. I keep hearing tales about this guy's strange behavior. He's got several cars, and he's got this car. He's the original owner. And he's got it down there, and he's painted it a kind of a weird color, I guess. And he's hot-rodded a little bit, but he doesn't want to sell it. It isn't for sale for any price, so I've been told. Sylvie did sell his, and I traded mine, really, because I didn't need two, and I'm moving to California, and I don't need two of them. I don't need two problems. One is enough, and they are problems because they're all prototype cars, all six of them, and they're fraught with problems: cooling problems, brake problems, handling problems. Not too bad on the handling end of it. Although I'll tell you a little story about this red car that I have. When I was getting after I got the transmission and engine situation sorted out. Now, the engine in this car, the red car that I kept, was okay. The bell housing was not hurt when it hit the famous manhole cover. Mm-hmm. And so when I did wind up with all these transmissions, that, you know, 4 years after the program was canceled, we get this note at American Motors that there's a bunch of transmissions with a tremendous storage bill and a tremendous shipping bill to be paid if they shipped them. Otherwise, what should they do? Should they scrap them or what? Whatever. And I, this came in and came to my office, my attention. I talked to Jerry Myers, and he said, God, there's a transmission. We wonder what happened to those. And so this was like a Christmas present, really, because I needed one desperately for both of my cars. They were both pulled up lame. And, of course, the number one car over in Kalamazoo needed one, although I don't think that car will ever run again. But it may. I don't know. I suppose if you want to spend enough money and build another prototype, which is about what it amounts to, you could do it. So we needed three of those right here. Sylvie's car was okay, and whatever this guy's name is down in Indianapolis had the other one. They were okay. They didn't have the manhole problem, cover problem. So anyway, these transmissions were over there, and Jerry said, fine, you can have them, get them over here if you want to, or we'll scrap them over there. What do you want to do? Your call. So I said, hey, I can't see those things scrapped. And so I got them over here, and that's another long story. I let one of them go, one of the spares. Of course, I put new ones in both of my cars. And then the car that I just sold, I let the guy have another transmission, one of the units. We just uncrated it last Saturday, and there were two in each crate. And they're the last of the Mohegans, and the others have gone to the Four Winds. I sold them to a guy across the street, and he sold them to Gratiot Auto Supply. And they were selling for $850 a piece, which was a hell of a buy because it cost American Motors $3,000 a piece.
Who made them, remember?
Ocho Molara. Ocho. Well, the spelling of the company that built the transaxles for this car was Ocho Molara, O-T-O, two words, Ocho, O-T-O, M-E-L-A-R-A, and they're in Laverno, Italy, which is where Vizzarini is from. That's just a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, the my two cars, the number 3 and 5 car, are now running and in great shape. In fact, with the exception of the first car, they're all operational vehicles in various stages of condition. But anyway, that was a neat program, and it when it was canceled, it was, you know, we all felt.
Why was it canceled, by the way?
Why was it canceled? Well, Siegel, he may have had some shortcomings, but one thing.
How do you spell his name, by the way? Siegel.
Oh God, I think it's S-E-I-G-L-E.
Okay, or E-L.
Yeah, or E-L, Siegel. Hal Siegel.
You had deputized him to oversee the program in Europe.
Yeah, Jerry had he was a good friend of Jerry Myers, and they Jerry. I'll tell you one thing about Siegel. He was a bird dog of the most fantastic type. And anybody else, the program would have been canceled probably 6 months or a year before that, because he was a guy that couldn't take no for an answer. And he was running around Italy over there. I was over there a couple of times when he was there, and he was like a madman because he. He just he had so many balls in the air to try to get this thing going, and he was talking to all the bodybuilders to try to get this price down to, like, I think the price was $5,000 or $6,000 delivered to New York at the dock. That's for the whole body in the white. That didn't include the mechanicals, which was separate from that. But Jerry was shooting for this $5,000 figure. I'm sure it was five more. Think about it. It was $5,000 that, and they were going to sell for 10 here, and he felt the difference would be made up with the mechanicals, which weren't that expensive, and but the whole shell, everything but the mechanicals. That, and when I say mechanicals, I'm talking about the transaxle and the engine, and wheels were even included in that price, and nobody could meet the price, and on top of that, the $5,000 had to include the amortization of the tooling to get the car, and it was just absolutely impossible to do that. Nobody would take it. God, they're not going to lose money on every car they build. Although they, you know, emotionally, they all liked the car, and they liked the fact that they were working with American Motors, and it was going to get a lot of publicity for whatever company that would be interested in, Carmen for one, Touring for another. Even Vizzarini at one time was talking about maybe setting up some kind of a shop and building, but he couldn't meet the figures. It was just impossible, because Jerry didn't want to put out the money. We didn't have the money to put out, you know, just $15, $20 million worth of tooling. There's just no way of doing it, and having it pay back with a limited number of cars that were programmed for the vehicle. And so it, you know, by the time all of the mathematics were in and all the arithmetic was figured and they got the computers running, they figured that it just, they couldn't do it. And I think the lowest price they ever got on the thing was close to 10, and that included a big chunk of amortizing the cost of the tooling to get the car, because every panel on it was different. There was very little interchangeability with anything that we had made. Some of the mechanic front suspension was quite similar, steering of course and things like that, but all the sheet metal was all new from the ground up, and the glass planes and everything else, you know, it was a different car. And there wasn't enough money in the budgeted program to do it. That plus the fact, well, that was the fact that we couldn't get anybody to do it and sell us a completed vehicle for the cost that Jerry had laid down that it should sell for. And he was going to hold it as $10,000, and I think at one time he considered maybe 11. But you know, if it was 11, it was more than a Pantera, and he got Ford selling Panteras through their vast dealership with a reputation for racing with GT40s and things in the past, and their total racing history going back to the 999, that, you know, we didn't have that kind of a reputation. And Jerry was right, and our dealership were not at that time, or not even now, you know, the kind of a thing. You know, how many would the dealers buy? They'd buy one for themselves, or and that's it. And, you know, we had, at that time, had, I don't know, 1,200 dealers or something. So it just, but all of those things should have been really thought out. And as good as Jerry is, as a, one of being the chairman of the board, you know, he should have really, I think, done a lot more homework on that car before we ever pushed a lot of buttons that we pushed. But in any event, we did build six cars, and we got a tremendous amount of publicity. Carl Ludwigson, a famous writer and a good friend of mine, did a, you know, did a tremendous story in Road and Track, and I still have that issue, of course. Mm-hmm. And it had my car, the red car, on the cover, and, you know, he was very up on the whole program. But even in that write-up of that rundown on the whole car, they did cutaways, not Inamoto cutaways, but some pretty damn good production illustrator did a cutaway of the car and showed the location of all the componentry and stuff. But even with all of that great publicity, geez, you couldn't help but wonder, when Siegel was having all this problem finding a bodybuilder in Europe or anywhere to build this thing, you know, if the program was really going to get off the ground. But it made a hell of a good, it was all part of the get away from the Rambler Ma and Pa Kettle image, mm-hmm. and it helped. You know, it was right on the tail end of the two-passenger AMX. In fact, it was introduced before that car was really dead, and that was only, you know, we made this, the production car made from the Javelin I mentioned earlier was introduced in 68 and 69. It was a full year, and then 70 it was halfway. But, you know, that
projected run.
Of this, of the AMX 3,
yeah.
Had that happened? God, I'm trying to remember now. It wasn't very heavy. It was like 3,000 the first year. And of course, it was all dependent on finding a bodybuilder that could handle it.
Sure.
Carmen could have met that amount of cars. But I think the maximum was like about 5,000 cars a year. And but we, I'll tell you, we had so many inquiries and so many phone calls and mm-hmm. so many letters written in that people that had seen the car either at some of the auto shows or had seen the Road and Track article by Ludwigson, and plus a lot of other articles that were written on the car. There's a whole, you know, package of articles that were written on the car, and it really was very, very well received. You know, the mechanicals sounded good, and they were good, and the appearance of the car was, you know, that's a judgmental thing, but I personally think it's a good-looking car. Even today, it looks good. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting up on the lawn up here, taking some pictures of it the other night. In fact, when I drive the car, whenever I drive it, they always ask me, you know, when's that car coming out? It doesn't look like one that's been out for 16 years. Mm-hmm. So it stood the test of time pretty well.
Most people think that's the high point of your career.
I guess, maybe. It was the most fun high point of my career, I'll tell you that. Everything else was just kind of working problems that you solve in many programs. But this was really an emotionally satisfying, a total program. It was, you know, I look back, as I mentioned before, it's kind of the Camelot years, that whole Javelin AMX, mm-hmm. AMX 3
yeah.
program. You know, if I were to chart, you know, the my fun part of my career, that would be the height of it.
Happy to be. What about, did you finally get a buyer? Any bodybuilder?
Never got one. Got one that could meet what Jerry had mandated the car should sell for. It was just impossible.
He would never go up, huh?
Well, at one time, God, I'm trying to remember now. I know Siegel had a lot of meetings with him, and you know, I think he had somebody that could come fairly close to it, but it wasn't really a quality house. I can't even recall who it was now. Oh, we even talked to Farina. You know, that's rolling the high stakes.
Uh-huh.
But they wouldn't even consider it for that kind of money. My God, they were selling Ferraris at that time for, you know, uh-huh. more than that, a lot more than that. But you know, still he couldn't. You know, Ferrari were paying more for bodies than Jerry was willing to pay for that. So it just wasn't a viable program. It just could never happen. The only way it could have happened, I guess, looking back on it, is in order to keep the tooling costs down, do a little bit like Ferrari did with their 308 when they brought that out. They initially introduced the 308 with a fiberglass body, and there's a few of those floating around. In fact, Jerry Palmer over at GM has got one now. It's a car that GM bought, but they, in order to get their foot in the door and get the cars out, they engineered and tooled it in fiberglass, which is a very unusual thing to do. I can't recall ever anybody doing that before, but they did. Ferrari, no less, did 308s in fiberglass. I don't know how many they made, but quite a number. And while they were doing that, they were also tooling a steel body for that, or aluminum, partially. And those 308s today are, they started out as, the first issues of those cars were fiberglass. We could have done something like that. Although in our case, I doubt if we'd have been able to double tool it because of the financial constraints. So had we ever considered, and we did consider the three as a fiberglass vehicle, but that would have meant, you know, tooling a frame, unless you went like Lotus done on a couple of cars. There hadn't been many cars that were total fiberglass envelopes, you know, the whole body frame, but there have been a few. And that was even considered, but with the wheelbase of this thing at 103, it was there's a lot of stress problems and a thing like that, and it was thought of and then discarded immediately. And then another plan was that, you know, we had all these meetings to try to figure how we're going to build this devil, because we had such good reception of the car and everybody wanted it, except nobody could, you know, you couldn't build a car for what Jerry was holding the cost down to, and it was just impossible, absolutely impossible. A car, you know, if we could have sold the car through our dealer body, which was, you know, never been really all that swift. They're not the type of guys that could sell even $10,000 cars, let alone 15, which is what this car probably would have had to have sold for. Against Ford selling Panteras at 10, no way, Jose. You know, there's just, you couldn't do that. And even the Pantera went up, and you know, they had, you know, mighty Ford back of it, and building those in Italy. We were trying to parallel our program, but it just the cards were not there. The money was not there. We couldn't do it.
So it was back to the bread and butter items.
Yeah. Back to the bread and butter items. In the meantime, we're building 2+2 Javelin AMXs, and we built those for several years. And
those went over pretty well.
Pretty good, yeah. In fact, it kind of justified. I know Bill Lindenberg used to kind of rub my nose in a little bit once we made the 2+2, which of course Ford had experience by moving from in 1955, 56, 57. But I used to throw back at him. I said, yeah, but Corvette have never gone to a 2+2, you know, and never will. Mm-hmm. This was years ago. But he said, nah, that's all right, too. They're a different dealer. You know, anyway, I couldn't win that battle. There's no way. But we did sell the first couple of years of the Javelin AMX. I don't know what the figures were now, but they weren't all that bad. But there were a certain demographic group out there that, you know, they really don't want a two-place car. Mm-hmm. They want enough room for the kids, at least. And we did have that in the old two-passenger,
right,
because there was a big area back there that, in fact, we even made some kind of a couple of the interior programs we went through with that. We put some kind of padded cushions back there for bassinets or young 3 or 4 year old kids. Mm-hmm. But it was not to me. It was the 2+2 that came out in 71 that kind of replaced that, and that was the end of an era. That was the last two passenger car that we're going to build in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's a tremendous rebirth of two-passenger car interest. You know, you got the Fiero, of course, and the Honda are going to build a mid-engine two-place car, I keep hearing. And if they do, that'll be a damn good one. And, of course, there's a Fiat X19, which, you know, the Fiero is kind of patterned after a little bit as far as the layout is concerned. And there's a whole gaggle of others. You know, there's a Toyota
MR2,
and there's, you know, there's a hell of a lot of cars coming out. And they're out now. They're two-place cars, mid-engine. I always really secretly, very honestly, would like to take one of these MR2, Fiero, whatever, and do really a modern AMX3, an AMX4 as an example,
right,
that would be state-of-the-art, the mechanicals and, you know, automatic transmission availability, which wasn't there when this was,
uh-huh,
if you wanted automatic, but it would be nice to have both, manual and the automatic. And I'd like to replay the AMX 3 thing again. In fact, I kind of leaned a little bit in that direction on a car that I just, in fact, as we speak, I should call about this morning, because it's coming together pretty well. It's over on the east side. Triad are putting together a pace car that has a lot of AMX 3 blood in it. In fact, I took my red car down when I was doing the clay model of this thing. And this has really been a labor of love. I don't get anything out of it but except satisfaction and no committees. And I'll tell you, that's worth the effort.
Triad is doing it.
It's Poker Valley's over 10 mile in Hoover, and it's a combination. It's Triad and Carcraft, and it's Chuck Mountain and Mike Pocabella. They're a couple of neat guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they were contracted with by PPG, working with me to style a car, to build a pace car for the 1984-85 season. And actually, it started last fall. It could have been the 84 season, but they've had some breech berth problems in getting the thing off the ground, and they've got other programs that have superseded this one. So it's a little bit late, but it's kind of ageless anyway. They're only going to build one car. In fact, they're just building one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost finished now. In fact, it'll probably make its debut on the 22nd of September in down here at MIS. It was supposed to make...
in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was supposed to make the Elkhart Lake show here about a week ago.
Uh-huh.
Didn't make that, and it didn't make the previous MIS show, strictly because of a lot of things. I don't know. That was only a target introduction time anyway. These things really don't have a... None of these pace cars have a firm completion date. Yeah, there's one that they put out there, they throw a dart at the board and say, hey, yeah, we're going to try to finish then. But if they don't make that one, there's 14 races a year, they make the next one. So it really isn't that critical as far as a timing thing is concerned. In fact, I've been working on this damn thing for, you know, not steady by any means, but I think I laid the thing out last, I don't know, year sometime, last 84. And it's coming along really well. It's kind of a intriguing looking car. It's based on an Alpine A310. What we did, like they do on most of these cars, or the earlier PPG cars, Fred Roux has had this program in effect for about 5 years now, almost 5 years. And
is
I've
it
done.
PPG?
Yeah, it's a PPG, Fred Roux, R-H-U-E.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with this concept and came in to see me in the office here about 5 years ago and said, hey, Teague, what do you think of this? He said, what we're going to do? He said, in order to, he said, we're in the paint business. And he said, we're going to sponsor some kart races, you know, and these are Indy cars, and we're going to get in some sponsorship. I guess he'd come into a big budget program, or he was trying to spend some money somewhere to get the name PPG, you know, a household word, which he has really done in the last 4 or 5 years, and because nobody knew really what PPG was outside of the industry, but
this is
Pittsburgh Plate Glass. Right. Yeah, it's an old name, goes way back to the Parthenon, but he's in the paint or finish business, and he's the head of that group, and it's been a tremendous thing for PPG. I think I have no reason to say that except it's been a lot of fun from my standpoint, and they give me some tickets 3 or 4 times a year, and that's all I get out of it, which is enough, because as I say, when Fred Roux came in, he said, Teague, how would you like to design a car without committees? I remember the comment. I said, boy, I'll kiss you on Hudson's window on Christmas Day at high noon if you can do that. And I said, what's the car? And then he went on to relay this program that he was thinking about that would involve having each one of the companies do as radical a car as you want, although it started out kind of low-key. It was just paint and trim and, you know, change the bumpers and, you know, do a few minor things with fiberglass. But now this program has blossomed into a whole series of project cars that are very, very exotic. In fact, they could almost stay in the race once they pace it.
Really?
Yeah, they're, well, this one, as an example, is one that, the last one that I've done, I've dubbed the Alpine Twin Turbo, has cost almost $400,000. Now, that's a lot of money, but it's a full-blown race car. So, anyway, we started out rather slow in the program, and we took a Spirit and made an AMX out of it, and did some things. This is about 5 years ago, the very first one. And they put a 401 engine in it and did some other good things, and that was used for one season, and then the next one I took a Spirit and rebodied that, and that was a 6-cylinder car, and there's a guy by the name of Bill Lachlan down in Akron that did the engine, and he put a fantastic turbocharger on that one, and that car is still, I mean, I think even to this day is one of the fastest cars of all of the PPG pace cars, including all of Mighty GM's team of vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the second one, and then the third one, the Spirit was dead at that time, or dying, so, and we were allied with, working with Renault, so mm-hmm. I used a Renault R5 Turbo. It's one of their stock cars, and we brought this car in, and then we rebodied that thing entirely, and I put gull wing doors on it and stuff, and it was built over to Synthetex, and that was really a fun program.
And where are they?
And that was, we took a base car, you know, the standard car right out of the box, right off the boat, standard car, and then just totally destroyed the exterior of the vehicle. Took everything off it, and then used that chassis or that platform and all of its components as an armature, built a whole wooden frame over that thing, so we know where all the peg points were for sure,
mm-hmm.
although it's a mid-engine car, and so there's no problem under the hood, but in this case, the engine's in the back seat. So we retained all of the mechanicals and the hard points and built an armature over that, and then a clay model over that, and then took female moles off of that, and then took male moles out of the female moles and built the car, and then hung the components back on the chassis after taking all of the stuff that we had used as an armature off of the car, obviously.
And where is Synthetex?
So Synthetex is over in Wayne near the airport. Mm-hmm. It's almost on the runway.
Custom.
Yeah, they build a lot of special cars. It's under Ron Mondrish. He's a nice guy, and he's a very competent guy and builds a lot of stuff for Ford, and used to build a lot of stuff for Chrysler. He can't get sideways with them, and he doesn't build anything for Chrysler anymore, but he does a lot of stuff for Ford in particular, and GM and PPG. He's built a number of PPG cars over there, with pace cars, including the Art Center car, which was a PPG car slash pace car.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how many cars they built that is PPG have sponsored, but it's got to be, I'm just guessing now, but it's got to be probably like 15 or more. They've got a Buick that they're doing over Triad alongside of the Alpine, and that's the wildest looking car I've ever seen. Well, just to finish the cars that I've done for them on a freebie basis, the first one was an AMX, so-called. And the second one was a Spirit. The third one was this Gullwing R5 Turbo, make from a standard vehicle, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The third one was a car that I dubbed the Wedge, and this was a kind of a radical-looking little car. It looks like a doorstop. And that's now, as we are sitting here, that is up at Auto World, and it's on a display that PPG sponsor at Auto World. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of the cars kind of cantilevered out from a central column. And there's, as you walk up this kind of a radial ramp, you walk around these cars, and they're all jutting out from the central spline or central column, and they're on little platforms that stick out. It's very dramatic. They have
This is in Flint.
It's in Flint, yeah, and it's worth going to Auto World just to see those pace cars, because they're very dramatic, and it's up there. It paced a couple of cars, and driven by Scott Braden a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
But once these cars are retired or they're used a number of times, they generally either dispose of the cars or do something with them. They were talking about at one time making a pace car museum for PPG, but that kind of fell through the boards. But so that was the Wedge, and then the last one, again because of Renault's influence and my working there as a design chief, I decided that we ought to do even a third one, because we really didn't have anything in the works that would be. You know, we built Jeeps, and you don't want to make a cheap pace car, although you could, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we dropped most of the passenger cars. The Concord was gone, and the only thing we built with an AMC logo anymore is the Eagle, and that's built over in Brampton.
Mm-hmm.
But so I felt that if you took an Alpine A310, which is a rear engine, not mid-engine, rear engine vehicle, 2.8 liter engine, V6 engine that's in the tail mounted. In fact, it's a very similar engine and layout that the DeLorean. That's not exactly a plus to mention that, I guess, but he bought those engines and wound up with a big bill to Renault, which he never paid for engines. Same sort of thing, same sort of layout. It's really a rear engine car. It's not a mid engine, but this particular vehicle that I've done for PPG, the last one, which will make its debut, I guess, in about a month or so. If they meet that date. If they miss that one, then it'll be Arizona, I guess, in November or something. But that car is almost finished now. It's about 80%, maybe 90. I'm going over there this next week, so I'll know how far along it is. I was over there 2 weeks ago, and it's on its wheels now. And they didn't have any interior in it, and all the grill work is not there, and they haven't road tested it or anything like that. But it's a kind of a sweet looking car, I think. I say immodestly. I don't mean to sound that way at all. But
where will it be a pace car?
It'll be a pace car at any one of the 14 to 16, depending on what their schedule is, races that they have throughout the country, from the East Coast to the West Coast and everything in between.
Which group is this?
it's the PPG kart, their kart races, their Indy
yeah.
cars.
Yeah, right.
The kart cars all run at Indy too, but PPG, because of contractual arrangements, do not have. Of course, that's sponsored by one of the, usually GM. In fact, this last year was Oldsmobile?
Mm-hmm.
Or Buick. No, it was Buick.
Yeah.
And Oldsmobile year four. But anyway, they pick up the sponsorship for the kart race at Indianapolis on Memorial Day. And but all of the other races, that the Indy cars run in, so-called kart, they have the PPG cars there, and they have girls driving, and they have 4 to 6 of them down there at every race, and this will take its place amongst those cars when it's completed. But it was a fun car. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's kind of the last gasp for me, I guess, as far as, although Fred Roux said he wants me to do another car in California and work with the Art Center kids, and that would be kind of fun. But I don't know, I'm 61 years old now, and I guess that's not really antique, but it's getting up there, and I'd like to kind of stop and smell the roses and do some things that I want to do with my wife and travel and do some other things. Although I do miss it very much. I miss, I used to lead for many years this Jekyll and Hyde life. I sometimes wondered which one was Jekyll and which one was Hyde, but I've always been able to, this interest in classic cars and vintage sports cars and antique cars and all that stuff has always been kind of a backup for me in a way. And backup, by that I mean therapeutic in a way, because I'm not a great television watcher, and I don't play golf, and I don't sail, and I do a lot of things that other people do, and I'm not a social guy. I don't even belong to a country club. I guess I'm kind of an enigma or a strange guy when it comes to that, because I've never been very social. I'm just what I am, and that's all I am, as Popeye used to say. I am what I am, and that's all I am. But anyway, I've had fun, and I came back a long ways from where I was born and raised and brought up in Southern California. I've come a long ways, not in career-wise, I don't mean to sound make it sound that way, but I've come a long ways geographically. You know, it's 2,500 miles. I detest winter with a passion, not because I'm from California, but I just don't like cold weather. Anyway, I've had a lot of fun back here and doing what I wanted to do, which is, what everybody tries to do, I guess. As soon as you realize that you got to go out and earn a living sometime, I guess when you're a young guy in your teenage years, I guess you set certain goals. And I always, my mother taught me to do that. She said, meet a goal or have a goal and try to meet it, and do what you want to do and be happy with what you want to do. And that really is kind of been the way it's been with me, and I've always done, and I'm blessed with a great wife that has put up with my idiosyncrasies.
Her name?
Marion. Mm-hmm. We've been married almost 35 years, be 35 years, which is, again, kind of unusual in this business, because, God, these guys have multiple wives from time to time. But anyway, Marion is a super gal. I don't know what I ever did to deserve her, but anyway, we have 3 fine children, and they're all doing well. 2 of those guys are designers. Both the boys are designers. They're both in California. That's another reason that's motivating me to go back to California to be with them. And our granddaughter, just got one of those, but one grandchild, but she's a great little guy. Her name is Tiffany, and she's just 7 years old. But they're out in California, and Rick, that's her father, he works for Ford in their advanced design group under Dick Hutting. And they have been a tremendous amount of interest in creating away from Detroit advanced design groups, and he's in Ford's version of that.
California Concepts.
In California Concepts.
Where's that located, by the way?
It's in Saugus, really. Saugus, Newhall area out there. It's in the northern end of the San Fernando Valley. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of a master of a lot of trades. That's Rick. He's 32 years old now, and he's always been good at models. When he was a kid, he used to build, customized models, and of course I used to encourage him as much as I could. And we used to build cars together and work on the antiques together, or the classics, or whatever I had, Ferraris or whatever. And so he's quite knowledgeable as far as automobiles are concerned, and he's doing a good job for Hutting, I guess. Jack Telnack at Meadowbrook the other day was bragging about him. He said he thought he's really a good man and does fine work. He does modeling. He does everything. He's not good at drawing, though. He's different, different kind of guy than that. He was always a 3D kind of a person, never 2D. He could model anything, and he could build anything, but he was never very good. He just didn't have the self-confidence or something that I tried to instill that in him, get him to take art courses, and God, I'd sit for hours and show him how to sketch, but he just didn't pick it up. He just was not bent in that direction, I guess.
Bill Stout was the same way.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He could only model.
Yeah. Well, Chuck Mashigan is a little bit, although he's pretty good at drawing too, but Chuck Mashigan, the guy that used to run Jeep for me, who's retired now too, is very good. And just like Michigan, only with an A.
Okay. Well.
Almost. M-A-S-H.
Right. Meshigan. We don't want to stint the post-AMX years in your career. Certainly they need to be chronicled.
Well,
you're still contending with Myers at this time?
Oh, yeah. Myers is still in there, wheeling and dealing. And anyway, we did a lot of, I guess we could talk for hours on the development of the some of the programs we had, the Project 3, or the Project 4, rather, and the Concept 80s and things like that that were really fun projects. And there were things that they were kind of lucky strike extras, throw-ins, as I call them, because we had the other production cars to do all this time, and we just had the burden, fun burden, admittedly, of doing these programs that would come through the door where they'd want either show cars or multiple show cars in the case of Concept 80, and where you'd do what you had in the gymnasium, as Evans used to call it, and you'd see what you had that were, you know, maybe viable production vehicles that you were contemplating building, and you could rework those things because we had them. We didn't have to start out from scratch. You could take one of those fiberglass shells in this example, and you could rework those in order to